so many methods of passing the time at Vozdvizhensko, and these were all unlike those in use at Pokrovsko. Un parte de lawn tennis, Veselovsky proposed with his handsome smile. We'll be partners again, Anna Arkadyevna. No, it's too hot. Better stroll about the garden and have a row in the boat. Show Darya Alexandrovna the riverbanks, Vronsky proposed. I agree to anything, said Sviazhsky. I imagine that what Dolly would like best would be a stroll, wouldn't you? And then the boat, perhaps, said Anna. So it was decided. Veselovsky and Tushkevich went off to the bathing place, promising to get the boat ready and to wait there for them. They walked along the path in two couples, Anna with Sviazhsky and Dolly with Vronsky. Dolly was a little embarrassed and anxious in the new surroundings in which she found herself. Abstractly, theoretically, she did not merely justify. She positively approved of Anna's conduct. As is indeed not infrequent with women of unimpeachable virtue, weary of the monotony of virtuous existence, at a distance she not only excused illicit love, she positively envied it. Besides, she loved Anna with all her heart. But seeing Anna in actual life among these strangers, with this fashionable tone that was so new to Darya Alexandrovna, she felt ill at ease. What she disliked particularly was seeing Princess Varvara ready to overlook everything for the sake of the comfort she enjoyed. As a general principle, abstractly, Dolly approved of Anna's action, but to see the man for whose sake her action had been taken was disagreeable to her. Moreover, she had never liked Vronsky. She thought him very proud and saw nothing in him of which he could be proud except his wealth. But against her own will, here in his own house, he imposed upon her more than ever, and she could not be at ease with him. She experienced with him the same feeling she had the maid about her dressing jacket. Just as with the maid, she had felt not exactly ashamed, but embarrassed at her darns, so she felt with him not exactly ashamed, but embarrassed at herself. Dolly was ill at ease and tried to find a subject of conversation, even though she supposed that, through his pride, praise of his house and garden would be sure to be disagreeable to him. She did, all the same, tell him how much she liked his house. Yes, it's a very fine building, and in the good old-fashioned style, he said. I like so much the court in front of the steps. Was that always so? Oh, no, he said, and his face beamed with pleasure. If you could only have seen the court last spring. And he began, at first rather diffidently, but more and more carried away by the subject as he went on, to draw her attention to the various details of the decoration of his house and garden. It was evident that, having devoted a great deal of trouble to improve and beautify his home, Vronsky felt the need to show off the improvements to a new person, and was genuinely delighted at Darya Alexandrovna's praise. If you would care to look at the hospital, and are not really tired, it's not far. Shall we go? He said, glancing into her face to convince himself that she was not bored. Are you coming, Anna? He turned to her. We will come, won't we? She said, addressing Sviazhsky. May il ne fat pas laisser le pauvre Veselovsky et Tushkevich se morfondre les dents les battues. We must send and tell them. Yes, this is a monument he is setting up here, said Anna, turning to Dolly with that sly smile of comprehension with which she had previously talked about the hospital. Oh, it's a work of real importance, said Sviazhsky. But to show he was not trying to ingratiate himself with Vronsky, he promptly added some slightly critical remarks. I wonder, though, Count, he said, that while you do so much for the health of the peasants, you take so little interest in the schools. C'est devenu tellement commune les écoles, said Vronsky. You understand it's not on that account, but it just happens so. My interest has been diverted elsewhere. This way, then, to the hospital, he said to Darya Alexandrovna, pointing to a side path leading out of the avenue. The ladies put up their parasols and turned into the side path. After going down several turnings and going through a little gate, Darya Alexandrovna saw standing on rising ground before her a large, pretentious-looking red building almost finished. The iron roof, which was not yet painted, shone with dazzling brightness in the sunshine. Beside the finished building, another had been begun, surrounded by scaffolding. Workmen in aprons standing on scaffolds were laying bricks, pouring mortar out of vats and smoothing it with trowels. "How quickly work gets done with you," said Sobieski. "When I was here last time, the roof was not on." "By the autumn, it will all be ready. Inside, almost everything is done," said Anna. "And what's this new building?" "That's the house for the doctor and the dispensary," answered Vronsky, seeing the architect in a short jacket coming toward him and excusing himself to the ladies. He went to meet him. Going round a hole where the workmen were slaking lime, he stood still with the architect and began talking rather warmly. "The pediment looks still too low," he said to Anna, who had asked what was the matter. "I said the foundation ought to be raised," said Anna. "Yes, of course, it would have been much better, Anna Arkadyevna," said the architect, "but now it's too late." "Yes, I take a great interest in it," Anna answered Sobieski, who was expressing his surprise at her knowledge of architecture. "This new building ought to have been in harmony with the hospital. It was an afterthought and was begun without a plan." Vronsky, having finished his talk with the architect, joined the ladies and led them inside the hospital. Although they were still at work on the cornices outside and were painting on the ground floor, upstairs almost all the rooms were finished. Going up the broad cast iron staircase to the landing, they walked into the first large room. The walls were stuccoed to look like marble. The huge plate glass windows were already in. Only the parquet floor was not yet finished, and the carpenters, who were planning a block of it, left their work, taking off the bands that fastened their hair to greet the gentry. "This is the reception room," said Vronsky. "Here there will be a desk, a cupboard, and benches, and nothing more." "This way, let us go in here." "Don't go near the window," said Anna, trying the paint to see if it were dry. "Alexei, the paint's dry already," she added. From the reception room, they went into the corridor. Here Vronsky showed them the mechanism for ventilation on a novel system. Then he showed them marble baths and beds with extraordinary springs. Then he showed them the wards, one after another, the storeroom, the linen room, then the heating stove of a new pattern, then the trolleys, which would make no noise as they carried everything needed along the corridors, and many other things. Sobieski, as a connoisseur in the latest mechanical improvements, appreciated everything fully. Dolly simply wondered at all as something she had not seen before, and anxious to understand it all, made minute inquiries about everything, which gave Vronsky apparent satisfaction. "Yes, I imagine that this will be the solitary example of a properly fitted hospital in Russia," said Sobieski. "And won't you have a lying-in ward?" asked Dolly. "That's so much needed in the country. I have often..." In spite of his usual courtesy, Vronsky interrupted her. "This is not a lying-in home, but a hospital for the sick, and is intended for all diseases, except infectious complaints," he said. "Ah, look at this." And he rolled up to Darya Alexandrovna, an invalid chair that had just been ordered for convalescents. "Look." He sat down in the chair and began moving it. "The patient can't walk, still too weak, perhaps, or something wrong with his legs, but he must have air, and he moves, rolls himself along." Darya Alexandrovna was interested by everything. She liked everything very much, but most of all she liked Vronsky himself, with his natural, simple-hearted enthusiasm. "Yes, he's a very dear, good man," she thought several times, not hearing what he said, but looking at him and penetrating into his expression, while she mentally put herself in Anna's place. She liked him so much just now with his eager interest that she saw how Anna could be in love with him. Chapter 21 "No, I think the princess is tired, and horses don't interest her," Vronsky said to Anna, who wanted to go on to the stud farm where Sobieski wished to see the new stallion. "You go on while I escort the princess home, and we'll have a little talk," he said. "If you would like that," he added, turning to her. "I know nothing about horses, and I shall be delighted to go back with you," answered Darya Alexandrovna, rather astonished. She saw by Vronsky's face that he wanted something from her. She was not mistaken. As soon as they had passed through the little gate back into the garden, he looked in the direction Anna had taken. and having made sure that she could neither hear nor see them, he began. "You guess that I have something I want to say to you," he said, looking at her with laughing eyes. "I am not wrong in believing you to be a friend of Anna's." He took off his hat, and taking out his handkerchief, wiped his head, which was growing bald. Darya Alexandrovna made no answer and merely stared at him with dismay. When she was left alone with him, she suddenly felt afraid. His laughing eyes and stern expression scared her. The most diverse suppositions as to what he was about to say to her flashed into her brain. "He is going to beg me to come to stay with them with the children, and I shall have to refuse, or to create a set that will receive Anna in Moscow. Or isn't it Vasenka Veslovsky and his relations with Anna? Or perhaps about Kitty, that he feels he was to blame?" All her conjectures were unpleasant, but she did not guess what he really wanted to talk about to her. "You have so much influence with Anna. She is so fond of you," he said. "Do help me." Darya Alexandrovna looked with timid inquiry into his energetic face, which under the linden trees was continually being lighted up in patches by the sunshine, and then passing into complete shadow again. She waited for him to say more, but he walked in silence beside her, scratching with his cane in the gravel. "You have come to see us, you, the only woman of Anna's former friends. I don't count Princess Varvara, but I know that you have done this, not because you regard our position as normal, but because, understanding all the difficulty of the position, you still love her and want to be a help to her. Have I understood you rightly?" he asked, looking round at her. "Oh, yes," answered Darya Alexandrovna, putting down her sunshade. "But no," he broke in, and unconsciously, oblivious of the awkward position in which he was putting his companion, he stopped abruptly so that she had to stop short, too. "No one feels more deeply and intensely than I do all the difficulty of Anna's position, and that you may well understand if you do me the honor of supposing I have any heart. I am to blame for that position, and that is why I feel it." "I understand," said Darya Alexandrovna, involuntarily admiring the sincerity and firmness with which he said this. "But just because you feel yourself responsible, you exaggerate it." "I am afraid," she said. "Her position in the world is difficult. I can well understand." "In the world, it is hell," he brought out quickly, frowning darkly. "You can't imagine moral sufferings greater than what she went through in Petersburg during that fortnight. And I beg you to believe it." "Yes, but here, so long as neither Anna nor you want society..." "Society," he said contemptuously. "How could I want society?" "So far, and it may be always so, you are happy and at peace. I see in Anna that she is happy, perfectly happy." "She has had time to tell me so much already," said Darya Alexandrovna, smiling. And involuntarily, as she said this, at the same moment a doubt entered her mind whether Anna really were happy. But Vronsky, it appeared, had no doubts on that score. "Yes, yes," he said. "I know that she has revived after all her sufferings. She is happy. She is happy in the present. But I am afraid of what is before us. I beg your pardon. You would like to walk on?" "No, I don't mind." "Well, then let us sit here." Darya Alexandrovna sat down on a garden seat in a corner of the avenue. He stood up, facing her. "I see that she is happy," he repeated, and the doubt whether she were happy sank more deeply into Darya Alexandrovna's mind. "But can it last?" "Whether we have acted rightly or wrongly is another question. But the die is cast," he said, "passing from Russian to French. And we are bound together for life. We are united by all the ties of love that we hold most sacred. We have a child. We may have other children. But the law and all the conditions of our position are such that thousands of complications arise which she does not see at present and does not want to see, setting her heart at rest after all these sufferings and ordeals. And that one can well understand, but I can't help seeing them. My daughter is by law not my daughter, but Karenin's. I cannot bear this falsity," he said, with a vigorous gesture of refusal, and he looked with gloomy inquiry toward Darya Alexandrovna. She made no answer, but simply gazed at him, and he went on. "One day a son may be born, my son, and he will be legally a Karenin. You will not be the heir of my name nor of my property. And however happy we may be in our home life, and however many children we may have, there will be no real tie between us. There will be Karenins. You will understand the bitterness and horror of this position. I have tried to speak of this to Anna. It irritates her. She does not understand. And to her I cannot speak plainly of all this. Now look at another side. I am happy. Happy in her love. But I must have occupation. I have found occupation. And am proud of what I am doing and consider it nobler than the pursuits of my former companions at court and in the army. And most certainly, I would not change the work I am doing for theirs. I am working here, settled in my own place, and I am happy and contented. And we need nothing more to make us happy. I love my work here. Si n'est pas un désolé, on the contrary. Darya Alexandrovna noticed that at this point in his explanation, he grew confused, and she did not quite understand his digression. But she felt that having once begun to speak of matters near his heart, of which he could not speak to Anna, he was now making a clean breast of everything, and that the question of his pursuits in the country fell into the same compartment of his intimate meditations as the question of his relations with Anna. "Well, I will go on," he said, collecting himself. "The great thing is that as I work, I want to have a conviction that what I am doing will not die with me, that I shall have heirs to come after me, and this I have not. Conceive the position of a man who knows that his children, the children of the woman he loves, will not be his, but will belong to someone who hates them and cares nothing about them. It is awful." He paused, evidently much moved. "Yes, indeed, I see that. But what can Anna do?" queried Darya Alexandrovna. "Yes, that brings me to the object of my conversation," he said, calming himself with an effort. "Anna can. It depends on her. Even to petition the Tsar for legitimization, a divorce is essential. And that depends on Anna. Her husband agreed to a divorce. At that time, your husband had arranged it completely. And now I know he would not refuse it. It is only a matter of writing to him. He said plainly at that time that if she expressed the desire, he would not refuse. Of course," he said gloomily, "it is one of those pharisaical cruelties of which only such heartless men are capable. He knows what agony any recollection of him must give her, and knowing her, he must have a letter from her. I can understand that it is agony to her, but the matter is of much importance, that one must pass her Padrusus, tout se finesse de sentiment. Il y va du bonheur et de l'existence d'Anna et sa enfance. I won't speak of myself, though it's hard for me, very hard," he said, with an expression as though he were threatening someone for its being hard for him. "And so it is, Princess, that I am shamelessly clutching at you as an anchor of salvation. Help me to persuade her to write to him and ask for a divorce." "Yes, of course," Darya Alexandrovna said dreamily, as she vividly recalled her last interview with Alexei Alexandrovich. "Yes, of course," she repeated with decision, thinking of Anna. "Use your influence with her. Make her write. I'm almost unable to speak about this to her." "Very well, I will talk to her. But how is it she does not think of it herself?" said Darya Alexandrovna. And for some reason, she suddenly, at that point, recalled Anna's strange new habit of half-closing her eyes. And she remembered that Anna drooped her eyelids just when the deeper questions of life were touched upon, just as though she half shut her eyes to her own life, so as not to see everything, thought Dolly. "Yes, indeed, for my own sake and for hers, I will talk to her," Dolly said in reply to his expression of gratitude. They got up and walked to the house. Chapter 22. When Anna found Dolly at home before her, she looked intently in her eyes as though questioning her about the talk she had had with Vronsky, but she made no inquiry in words. "I believe it's dinner time," she said. "We've not seen each other at all yet. I am reckoning on the evening. Now I want to go and dress. I expect you do, too. We all got splashed at the buildings." Dolly went to her room, and she felt amused. To change her dress was impossible, for she had already put on her best dress. But in order to signify in some way her preparation for dinner, she asked the maid to brush her dress, changed her cuffs and rosette, and put some lace on her head. "This is all I can do," she said with a smile to Anna, who came in to her in a third dress, again of extreme simplicity. "Yes, we are too prim here," she said, as it were apologizing for her finery. "Alexei is delighted at your visit, as he rarely is at anything. He has completely lost his heart to you," she added. "You're not tired?" There was no time for talking about anything before dinner. Going into the drawing room, they found Princess Varvara already there, and the gentlemen of the party in black frock coats. The architect wore a swallow-tail coat. Vronsky presented the doctor and the steward to his guest. The architect he had already introduced to her at the hospital. A stout butler, resplendent with a smoothly shaven round chin and a starched white cravat, announced that dinner was ready, and the ladies got up. Vronsky asked Shuyasky to take in Anna Arkadyevna, and himself offered his arm to Dolly. Veslovsky was before Tushkevich in offering his arm to Princess Varvara, so that Tushkevich with the steward and the doctor walked in alone. The dinner, the dining room, the service, the waiting at table, the wine and the food were not simply in keeping with the general tone of modern luxury throughout the house, but seemed even more sumptuous and modern. Darya Alexandrovna watched this luxury, which was novel to her, and as a good housekeeper used to manage a household, though she never dreamed of adapting anything she saw to her own household, as it was all in a style of luxury far above her own manner of living, she could not help scrutinizing every detail and wondering how and by whom it was all done. Vasenki Veslovsky, her husband, and even Shuyasky and many other people she knew would never have considered this question and would have readily believed what every well-bred host tries to make his guests feel. That is, that all that is well-ordered in his house has cost him, the host, no trouble whatever, but comes of itself. Darya Alexandrovna was well aware that even porridge for the children's breakfast does not come of itself, and that therefore, where so complicated and magnificent a style of luxury was maintained, someone must give earnest attention to its organization. And from the glance with which Alexei Kirillovich scanned the table, from the way he nodded to the butler and offered Darya Alexandrovna her choice between cold soup and hot soup, she saw that it was all organized and maintained by the care of the master of the house himself. It was evident that it all rested no more upon Anna than upon Veslovsky. She, Shuyasky, and the princess, and Veslovsky, were equally guests, with light hearts enjoying what had been arranged for them. Anna was the hostess only in conducting the conversation. The conversation was a difficult one for the lady of the house at a small table with persons present, like the steward and the architect, belonging to a completely different world, struggling not to be overawed by an elegance to which they were unaccustomed, and unable to sustain a large share in the general conversation. But this difficult conversation Anna directed with her usual tact and naturalness, and indeed she did so with actual enjoyment, as Darya Alexandrovna observed. The conversation began about the row Tushkevich and Veslovsky had taken alone together in the boat, and Tushkevich began describing the last boat races in Petersburg at the yacht club. But Anna, seizing the first pause, at once turned to the architect to draw him out of his silence. "Nikolai Ivanich was struck," she said, meaning Shuyasky, "at the progress the new building had made since he was here last, but I am there every day, and every day I wonder at a rate at which it grows." "It's first rate working with His Excellency," said the architect with a smile. He was respectful and composed, though with a sense of his own dignity. "It's a very different matter to have to do with the district authorities, where one would have to write out sheaves of papers. Here I call upon the Count, and in three words we settle the business." "The American way of doing business," said Shuyasky with a smile. "Yes, there they build in a rational fashion." The conversation passed to the misuse of political power in the United States, but Anna quickly brought it round to another topic, so as to draw the steward into talk. "Have you ever seen a reaping machine?" she said, addressing Darya Alexandrovna. "We had just ridden over to look at one when we met. It's the first time I ever saw one." "How do they work?" asked Dolly. "Exactly like scissors. A plank and a lot of little scissors, like this." Anna took a knife and fork in her beautiful white hands, covered with rings, and began showing how the machine worked. It was clear that she saw nothing would be understood from her explanation, but aware that her talk was pleasant and her hands beautiful, she went on explaining. "More like little penknives," Veslovsky said playfully, never taking his eyes off her. Anna gave a just perceptible smile but made no answer. "Isn't it true, Karl Peterich, that it's just like scissors?" she said to the steward. "Oh, yeah," answered the German. "Es ist ein ganz einfaches Ding," and he began to explain the construction of the machine. "It's a pity it doesn't bind, too. I saw one at the Vienna exhibition which binds with the wire," said Sviatsky. "They would be more profitable to use." "Es kommt drauf an. Der Preis von dort muss angerechnet werden." And the German, roused from his taciturnity, turned to Vronsky. "Das Leipzig Ostrichen Verlag." The German was just feeling in the pocket where were his pencils and the notebook he always wrote in. But recollecting that he was at a dinner and observing Vronsky's chilly glance, he checked himself. "Zu Kompositor, Max zu Wildpans," he concluded. "One schmanz gains, so hat man auch pains," said Vasenki Veslovsky, bantering the German. "J'adore l'Allemand," he addressed Anna again with the same smile. "Success," she said, with playful severity. "We expected to find you in the fields, Vasily Semyonich," she said to the doctor, a sickly-looking man. "Have you been there?" "I went there, but I evaporated," the doctor answered with gloomy jocoseness. "Then you've taken a good constitutional?" "Splendid." "Well, and how was the old woman? I hope it's not typhus." "Typhus it isn't, but she's not to be found to the best advantage." "What a pity," said Anna, and having thus paid the dues of civility to her domestic circle, she turned to her own friends. "It would be a hard task, though, to construct a machine from your description, Anna Arkadyevna," Sviatsky said jestingly. "Oh, no, why so?" said Anna with a smile that betrayed that she knew there was something charming in her disquisitions upon the machine that had been noticed by Sviatsky also. This new trait of girlish coquettishness made an unpleasant impression on Dolly. "But Anna Arkadyevna's knowledge of architecture is marvelous," said Tushkevich. "To be sure, I heard Anna Arkadyevna say yesterday, 'by cramp and plinths,'" said Veslovsky. "Have I got it right?" "There's nothing marvelous about it when one sees and hears so much of it," said Anna. "But I dare say you don't even know what houses are made of." Darya Alexandrovna saw that Anna disliked the tone of playfulness that existed between her and Veslovsky, but fell in with it against her will. Vronsky acted in this matter quite differently from Levin. He obviously attached no significance to Veslovsky's chattering. On the contrary, he enjoyed his jests. "Come now, tell us, Veslovsky, how are the stones held together?" "By cement, of course." "Bravo, and what is cement?" "Oh, some sort of paste." "No, putty," said Veslovsky, raising a general laugh. The company at dinner, with the exception of the doctor, the architect, and the steward, who remained plunged in gloomy silence, kept up a conversation that never paused, glancing off one subject, fastening on another, and at times stinging one or the other of the company to the quick. But once Darya Alexandrovna felt wounded to the quick and got so hot that she positively flushed and wondered afterward whether she had said anything extreme or unpleasant. So Vyashky began talking of Levin, describing his strange view that machinery is simply pernicious in its effects on Russian agriculture. "I have not the pleasure of knowing this Monsieur Levin," Vronsky said, smiling, "but most likely he has never seen the machines he condemns. Or if he has seen and tried any, it must have been after a queer fashion, some Russian imitation, not a machine from abroad. What sort of views could anyone have on such a subject?" "Turkish views in general," Veslovsky said, turning to Anna with a smile. I can't defend his opinions, Darya Alexandrovna said, flaring up, but I can say that he's a highly cultivated man, and if he were here, he would know very well how to answer you, though I am not capable of doing so. I like him extremely, and we are great friends, Sobieski said, smiling good-naturedly. Mais pardon, il est un petit couteau. He maintains, for instance, that zemstvos and justices of the peace are all of no use, and he is unwilling to take part in anything. It's our Russian apathy, said Vronsky, pouring water from an ice decanter into a delicate glass on the high stem. We've no sense of the duties our privileges impose upon us, and so we refuse to recognize these duties. I know no man more strict in the performance of his duties, said Darya Alexandrovna, irritated by Vronsky's tone of superiority. For my part, pursued Vronsky, who was evidently, for some reason or other, keenly affected by this conversation, such as I am, on the contrary, extremely grateful for the honor that they have done me, thanks to Nikolai Ivanich, he indicated Sobieski. In electing me an honorary justice of the peace, I consider that for me the duty of being present at the session, of judging some peasant's quarrel about a horse, is as important as anything I can do. And I shall regard it as an honor if they elect me for the district council. It's only in that way I can pay for the advantages I enjoy as a landowner. Unluckily, they don't understand the importance that the big landowners ought to have in the state. It was strange to Darya Alexandrovna to hear how serenely confident he was of being right at his own table. She thought how Levin, who believed the opposite, was just as positive in his opinions at his own table. But she loved Levin, and so she was on his side. So we can reckon upon you, Count, for the coming elections, said Sobieski, but you must come a little beforehand so as to be on the spot by the 8th. If you would do me the honor to stop with me. I rather agree with your beau-frère, said Anna, though not quite on the same ground as he, she added with a smile. I'm afraid that we have too many of these public duties in these later days. Just as in the old days, there were so many government functionaries that one had to call in a functionary for every single thing, so now everyone's doing some sort of public duty. Alexei has been here now 6 months, and he's a member, I do believe, of 5 or 6 different public bodies, a guardian, a justice of the peace, a member of the council, a juryman, an equine something. Du train qui se leva. His whole time will be wasted on it. And I'm afraid that with such a multiplicity of these bodies, they'll end in being a mere form. How many are you a member of, Nikolai Ivanich? She turned to Sobieski. Over 20, I fancy. Anna spoke lightly, but irritation could be discerned in her tone. Darya Alexandrovna, watching Anna and Vronsky attentively, detected it instantly. She noticed, too, that as she spoke, Vronsky's face had immediately taken a serious and obstinate expression. Noticing this, and that Princess Varvara at once made haste to change the conversation by talking of Peterburg acquaintances, and remembering what Vronsky had, without apparent connection, said in the garden of his work in the country, Dolly surmised that this question of public activity was connected with some deep private disagreement between Anna and Vronsky. The dinner, the wine, the dinner set were all very good, but it was all like what Darya Alexandrovna had seen at formal dinners and balls, which of late years had become quite unfamiliar to her. It all had the same impersonal and constrained character, and so on an ordinary day and in a little circle of friends, it made a disagreeable impression on her. After dinner they sat on the terrace, then they proceeded to play lawn tennis. The players, divided into two parties, stood on opposite sides of a tightly drawn net with gilt poles, on the carefully leveled and rolled croquet ground. Darya Alexandrovna made an attempt to play, but it was a long time before she could understand the game, and by the time she did understand it, she was so tired that she sat down with Princess Varvara and simply looked on at the players. Her partner, Trushkovich, gave up playing too, but the others kept the game up for a long time. Sobieski and Vronsky both played very well and seriously. They kept a sharp lookout on the balls served to them, and without loitering, they ran adroitly up to them, waited for the rebound, and neatly and accurately returned them over the net. Veslovsky played worse than the others. He was too eager, but he kept the players lively with his high spirits. His laughter and outcries never paused. Like the other men of the party, with the ladies' permission, he took off his coat, and his solid, comely figure, in his white shirt sleeves, with his red, perspiring face and his impulsive movements, made a picture that imprinted itself vividly on the memory. When Darya Alexandrovna lay in bed that night, as soon as she closed her eyes, she saw Vasenka Veslovsky flying about the croquet ground. During the game, Darya Alexandrovna was not enjoying herself. She did not like the light tone of playfulness that was kept up all the time between Vasenka Veslovsky and Anna, and the unnaturalness altogether of grown-up people, all alone without children, playing at a child's game. But to avoid breaking up the party and to get through the time somehow, after a rest she joined the game again and pretended to be enjoying it. All that day it seemed to her as though she were acting in a theater with actors cleverer than she, and that her bad acting was spoiling the whole performance. She had come with the intention of staying 2 days, if all went well, but in the evening, during the game, she made up her mind that she would go home next day. The maternal cares and worries which she had so hated on the way, now, after a day spent without them, stuck in her quite another light and tempted her back to them. When, after evening tea and a row by night in the boat, Darya Alexandrovna went alone to her room, took off her dress, and began arranging her thin hair for the night, she had a great sense of relief. It was positively disagreeable to her to think that Anna would be coming to see her immediately. She longed to be alone with her own thoughts. Chapter 23. Dolly was just about to go to bed when Anna came in to see her, attired for the night. In the course of the day, Anna had several times begun to speak of matters near her heart, and every time after a few words she had stopped. "Afterward, by ourselves, we'll talk about everything. I've got so much I want to tell you," she had said. Now they were by themselves, and Anna did not know what to talk about. She sat in the window looking at Dolly and going over in her own mind all the stories of intimate talk which had seemed so inexhaustible beforehand, and she found nothing. At that moment it seemed to her that everything had been said already. "Well, what of Kitty?" she said with a heavy sigh, looking penitently at Dolly. "Tell me the truth, Dolly. Isn't she angry with me?" "Angry? Oh, no," said Darya Alexandrovna, smiling. "But she hates me, despises me." "Oh, no, but you know that sort of thing isn't forgiven." "Yes, yes," said Anna, turning away and looking out of the open window. "But I was not to blame. And who is to blame? What's the meaning of being to blame? Could it have been otherwise? What do you think? Could it possibly have happened otherwise than that you should become the wife of Stiva? Really, I don't know. But this is what I want you to tell me." "Yes, yes, but we've not finished about Kitty. Is she happy? He's a very fine man, they say." "He's much more than very fine. I don't know a better man." "Ah, how glad I am. I'm so glad. Much more than very fine," she repeated. Dolly smiled. "But tell me about yourself. We've a great deal to talk about, and I've had a talk with..." Dolly did not know what to call him. She felt it awkward to call him either the Count or Alexei Kirillovich. "With Alexei," said Anna, "I know what you talked about, but I wanted to ask you directly what you think of me, of my life." "How am I to say anything so suddenly? I really don't know." "No, tell me all the same. You see my life, but you mustn't forget that you're seeing us in the summer, when you have come to us and we are not alone. But we came here early in the spring, lived quite alone, and shall be alone again, and I desire nothing better. But imagine me living alone without him, alone, and that will be, I see by everything that it will often be repeated, and that he will be half the time away from home," she said, getting up and sitting down close by Dolly. "Of course," she interrupted Dolly, who would have answered, "of course I won't try to keep him by force. I don't keep him, indeed. The races are just coming, his horses are running, he will go. I'm very glad. But think of me. Fancy my position. But what's the use of talking about it?" She smiled. "Well, what did he talk about with you?" "He spoke of what I want to speak about myself, and it's easy for me to be his advocate, of whether there is not a possibility, whether you could not, Darya Alexandrovna hesitated. Correct or improve your position. You know how I look at it, but all the same, if possible, you should get married. Divorce, you mean, said Anna. Do you know the only woman who came to see me in Petersburg was Betsy Tsverskaya? You know her, of course. Afan ses la femme la place de pravi qui existe. She had an intrigue with Tushkevich, deceiving her husband in the basest way, and she told me that she did not care to know me so long as my position was irregular. Don't imagine I would compare. I know you, darling, but I could not help remembering. Well, so what did he say to you? She repeated. He said that he was unhappy on your account and his own. Perhaps you will say that it's egoism, but what a legitimate and noble egoism. He wants, first of all, to legitimize his daughter and to be your husband, to have a legal right to you. What wife, what slave can be so utterly a slave as I, in my position, she put in gloomily. The chief thing he desires that you should not suffer. That's impossible. Well, and the most legitimate desire, he wishes that your children should have a name. What children? Anna said, not looking at Dolly, and half closing her eyes. Annie, and those to come. He need not trouble on that score. I shall have no more children. How can you tell it you won't? I shall not, because I don't wish it. And in spite of all her emotion, Anna smiled as she caught the naive expression of curiosity, wonder, and horror on Dolly's face. The doctor told me after my illness. Impossible, said Dolly, opening her eyes wide, for here this was one of those discoveries, the consequences and deductions from which are so immense that all that one feels for the first instant that it is impossible to take it all in, and that one will have to reflect a great, great deal upon it. This discovery, suddenly throwing light on all those families of one or two children, which had hitherto been so incomprehensible to her, aroused so many ideas, reflections, and contradictory emotions that she had nothing to say, and simply gazed with wide-open eyes of wonder at Anna. This was the very thing she had been dreaming of, but now, learning that it was possible, she was horrified. She felt that it was too simple a solution of too complicated a problem. Mais si pas immoral, was all she said after a brief pause. Why so? Think, I have a choice between two alternatives, either to be with child, that is, an invalid, or to be the friend and companion of my husband, practically my husband, Anna said in a tone intentionally superficial and frivolous. Yes, yes, said Darya Alexandrovna, hearing the very argument she had used to herself and not finding the same force in them as before. For you, for other people, said Anna, as though divining her thoughts, there may be reason to hesitate, but for me, you must consider, I am not his wife. He loves me as long as he loves me. And how am I to keep his love? Not like this. She moved her white hands in a curve before her waist. With extraordinary rapidity, as happens during moments of excitement, ideas and memories rushed into Darya Alexandrovna's head. I, she thought, did not keep my attraction for Stiva. He left me for others, and the first woman for whom he betrayed me did not keep him by being always pretty and lively. He deserted her and took another. And can Anna attract and keep Count Vronsky in that way? If that is what he looks for, he will find dresses and manners still more attractive and charming. And however white and beautiful her bare arms are, however beautiful her full figure and her eager face under her black curls, he will find something better still, just as my disgusting, pitiful, and charming husband does. Dolly made no answer. She merely sighed. Anna noticed this sigh, indicating dissent, and she went on. In her armory, she had other arguments so strong that no answer could be made to them. You say that it's not right, but you must consider, she went on. You forget my position. How can I desire children? I'm not speaking of the suffering. I'm not afraid of that. Think, only, what are my children to be? Ill-fated children who will have to bear a stranger's name. For the very fact of their birth, they will be forced to be ashamed of their mother their father, their birth. But that is just why a divorce is necessary. But Anna did not hear her. She longed to give utterance to all the arguments with which she had so many times convinced herself. What is reason given me for, if I am not to use it to avoid bringing unhappy beings into the world? She looked at Dolly, but without waiting for a reply, she went on. I should always feel I had wronged these unhappy children, she said. If there are none, at any rate they are not unhappy. Well, if they are unhappy, I alone should be to blame for it. These were the very arguments Darya Alexandrova had used in her own reflections, but she heard them now without understanding them. How can one wrong creatures that don't exist, she thought. And all at once the idea struck her. Could it possibly, under any circumstances, have been better for her favorite Grisha if he had never existed? And this seemed to her so wild, so strange, that she shook her head to drive away this tangle of whirling mad ideas. No, I don't know. It's not right, was all she said, with an expression of disgust on her face. Yes, but you mustn't forget what you are and what I am. And besides that, added Anna, in spite of the wealth of her arguments and the poverty of Dolly's objections, seeming still to admit that it was not right, don't forget the chief point, that I am not now in the same position as you. For you, the question is, do you desire not to have any more children? While for me it is, do I desire to have them? And that's a great difference. You must see that I can't desire them in my position. Darya Alexandrovna made no reply. She suddenly felt that she had got away from Anna so far that there lay between them a barrier of questions on which they could never agree, and about which it was better not to speak. Chapter 24. Then there is all the more reason for you to legalize your position, if possible, said Dolly. Yes, if possible, said Anna, speaking all at once in an utterly different tone, subdued and mournful. Surely you don't mean a divorce is impossible. I was told your husband had consented to it. Dolly, I don't want to talk about that. Oh, we won't then, Darya Alexandrovna hastened to say, noticing the expression of suffering on Anna's face. All I see is that you take too gloomy a view of things. I, not at all. I'm very satisfied and happy. You see, je fais passions. Veslovsky? Yes, to tell the truth, I don't like Veslovsky's tone, said Darya Alexandrovna, anxious to change the subject. Oh, that's nonsense. It amuses Alexei, and that's all. But he's a boy and quite under control. You know, I turn him as I please. It's just as I might be with your Grisha. Dolly, she suddenly changed the subject. You say I take too gloomy a view of things. You can't understand. It's too awful. I try not to take any view of it at all. But I think you ought to. You ought to do all you can. But what can I do? Nothing. You tell me to marry Alexei and say I don't think about it. I don't think about it, she repeated. And a flush rose into her face. She got up, straightening her chest, and sighed heavily. With her light step, she began pacing up and down the room, stopping now and then. I don't think of it. Not a day, not an hour passes that I don't think of it, and blame myself for what I think, because thinking of that may drive me mad. Drive me mad, she repeated. When I think of it, I can't sleep without morphine. But never mind. Let us talk quietly. They tell me, divorce. In the first place, he won't give me a divorce. He's under the influence of Countess Lydia Ivanovna now. Darya Alexandrovna, sitting erect on a chair, turned her head, following Anna with a face of sympathetic suffering. You ought to make the attempt, she said softly. Suppose I make the attempt. What does it mean, she said, evidently giving utterance to a thought, a thousand times thought over and learned by heart. It means that I, hating him, but still recognizing that I have wronged him, and I consider him magnanimous, that I humiliate myself to write to him, well, suppose I make the effort. I do it. Either I receive a humiliating refusal or consent. Well, I have received his consent, say. Anna was at that moment at the farthest end of the room, and she stopped there, doing something to the curtain at the window. I receive his consent, but my son... They won't give him up to me. He will grow up despising me with his father whom I've abandoned. Do you see? I love equally, I think, but both more than myself. Two beings, Seriosha and Alexei. She came out into the middle of the room and stood facing Dolly with her arms pressed tightly across her chest. In her white dressing gown, her figure seemed more than usually grand and broad. She bent her head and, with shining, wet eyes, looked from under her brows at Dolly, a thin, little, pitiful figure in her patched dressing jacket and nightcap, shaking all over with emotion. It is only those two beings whom I love, and one excludes the other. I can't have them together, and that's the only thing I want. And since I can't have that, I don't care about the rest. I don't care about anything, anything. And it will end one way or another, and so I can't. I don't like to talk of it. So don't blame me. Don't judge me for anything. You can't, with your pure heart, understand all that I'm suffering. She went up, sat down beside Dolly, and with a guilty look, peeped into her face and took her hand. What are you thinking? What are you thinking about me? Don't despise me. I don't deserve contempt. I'm simply unhappy. If anyone is unhappy, I am, she uttered, and turning away, she burst into tears. Left alone, Dolly said her prayers and went to bed. She had felt for Anna with all her heart while she was speaking to her, but now she could not force herself to think of her. The memories of home and of her children rose up in her imagination with a peculiar charm quite new to her, with a sort of new brilliance. That world of her own seemed to her now so sweet and precious that she would not on any account spend an extra day outside it, and she made up her mind that she would certainly go back the next day. Anna, meantime, went back to her boudoir, took a wine glass, and dropped into it several drops of a medicine, of which the principal ingredient was morphine. After drinking it off and sitting still a little while, she went into her bedroom in a soothed and more cheerful frame of mind. When she went into the bedroom, Vronsky looked intently at her. He was looking for traces of the conversation which he knew, staying so long in Dolly's room, she must have had with her. But in her expression of restrained excitement and of a sort of reserve, he could find nothing but the beauty that always bewitched him afresh, though he was used to it, the consciousness of it and the desire that it should affect him. He did not want to ask her what they had been talking of, but he hoped that she would tell him something of her own accord. But she only said, "I am so glad you like Dolly. You do, don't you? Oh, I've known her a long while. She's very good-hearted, I suppose. May excessive meant tear a tear. Still, I'm very glad to see her." He took Anna's hand and looked inquiringly into her eyes. Misinterpreting the look, she smiled to him. Next morning, in spite of the protests of her host, Darya Alexandrovna prepared for her homeward journey. Levin's coachman and his by no means new coat and shabby hat, with his ill-matched horses and his carriage with the patched mudguards, drove with gloomy determination into the covered gravel approach. Darya Alexandrovna disliked taking leave of Princess Varvara and the gentlemen of the party. After a day spent together, both she and her host were distinctly aware that they did not get on together, and that it was better for them not to meet. Only Anna was sad. She knew that now, after Dolly's departure, no one again would stir up within her soul the feelings that had been roused by their conversation. It hurt her to stir up these feelings, but yet she knew that that was the best part of her soul, and that that part of her soul would quickly grow weedy in the life she was leading. As she drove out into the open country, Darya Alexandrovna had a delightful sense of relief, and she felt tempted to ask the two men how they had liked being at Vronsky's, when suddenly the coachman, Philip, expressed himself unasked. "Rolling in wealth they may be, but three pots of oats was all they gave us. Everything cleared up till there wasn't a grain left by cockcrow. What are three pots? A mere mouthful. And oats, now you could get from innkeepers for 45 kopecks. At our place, no fear. All comers may have as much as they can eat." "The master's a screw," put in the counting house clerk. "Well, did you like their horses?" asked Dolly. "The horses? There's no two opinions about them. And the food was good. But it seemed to me sort of dreary there, Darya Alexandrovna. I don't know what you thought, he said, turning his handsome, good-natured face to her. I thought so, too. Well, shall we get home by evening? Eh, we must. On reaching home and finding everyone entirely safe and particularly charming, Darya Alexandrovna began with great liveliness, telling them about her arrival, her warm reception, about the luxury and good taste in which the Vronskys lived, and about their recreations, and she would not allow a word to be said against them. One has to know Anna and Vronsky. I have got to know him better now, to see how fine they are and how touching, she said, speaking now with perfect sincerity and forgetting the vague feeling of dissatisfaction and awkwardness she had experienced there. Chapter 25. Vronsky and Anna spent the whole summer and part of the autumn in the country, living in just the same condition and still taking no steps to obtain a divorce. It was a decided thing between them that they should not go away anywhere, but both felt, the longer they lived alone, especially in the autumn, and without guests in the house, that they could not stand this existence, and that they would have to change it. Their life was apparently such that nothing better could be desired. They had the fullest abundance of everything. They had a child, and both had occupation. Anna devoted just as much care to her appearance when they had no visitors, and she did a great deal of reading, both of novels and of what serious literature was in fashion. She ordered all the books that were praised in the foreign papers and journals she received, and read them with that concentrated attention which is only given to what is read in seclusion. Moreover, every subject that was of interest to Vronsky she studied in books and special journals, so that he often went straight to her with questions relating to agriculture or architecture, sometimes even with questions relating to horse breeding or sport. He was amazed at her knowledge, her memory, and at first was disposed to doubt it, to ask for confirmation of her facts, and she would find what he asked for in some book and show it to him. The building of the hospital, too, interested her. She did not merely assist, but planned and suggested a great deal herself. But her chief thought was still of herself, how far she was dear to Vronsky, how far she could make up to him for all he had given up. Vronsky appreciated this desire not only to please but to serve him, which had become the sole aim of her existence. But at the same time he wearied of the loving sneers in which she tried to hold him fast. As time went on and he saw himself more and more often held fast in these snares, he had an ever-growing desire, not so much to escape from them, as to try whether they hindered his freedom. Had it not been for this growing desire to be free, not to have scenes every time he wanted to go to the town to a session or a race, Vronsky would have been perfectly satisfied with his life. The role he had taken up, the role of a wealthy landowner, one of that class which ought to be the very heart of the Russian aristocracy, was entirely to his taste. And now, after spending 6 months in that role, he derived even greater satisfaction from it. And his management of his estate, which occupied and absorbed him more and more, was most successful. In spite of the immense sums which the hospital, the machinery, the cows ordered from Switzerland, and many other things cost him, he was convinced that he was not wasting but increasing his substance. In all matters affecting income, the sales of timber, wheat, and wool, the letting of lands, Vronsky was hard as a rock and knew well how to keep up prices. In all operations on a large scale on this and his other estates, he kept to the simplest methods involving no risk, and in trifling details he was careful and exacting to an extreme degree. In spite of all the cunning and ingenuity of the German steward, who would try to tempt him into purchases by making his original estimate always far larger than really required, and then representing to Vronsky that he might get the thing cheaper and so make a profit, Vronsky did not give in. He listened to his steward, cross-examined him, and only agreed to his suggestions when the implement to be ordered or constructed was the very newest, not yet known in Russia, and likely to excite wonder. Apart from such exceptions, he resolved upon an increased outlay only where there was a surplus, and in making such an outlay he went into the minutest details, and insisted on getting the very best for his money, so that by the method on which he managed his affairs, it was clear that he was not wasting, but increasing his substance. In October there were the provincial nobility elections in the Kashinsky province. Where were the estates of Vronsky, Chvyavsky, Koznishev, Oblonsky, and a small part of Levin's land? These elections were attracting public attention from several circumstances connected with them, and also from the people taking part in them. There had been a great deal of talk about these elections, and great preparations were being made for them. Persons who never attended the elections were coming from Moscow, from Petersburg, and from abroad to attend these. Vronsky had long before promised Chvyavsky to go to them. Before the elections, Chvyavsky, who often visited Vozdvizhenskoe, drove over to fetch Vronsky. On the day before, there had been almost a quarrel between Vronsky and Anna over this proposed expedition. It was the very dullest autumn weather, which is so dreary in the country, and so preparing himself for a struggle, Vronsky, with a hard and cold expression, informed Anna of his departure as he had never spoken to her before. But to his surprise, Anna accepted the information with great composure and merely asked when he would be back. He looked intently at her, at a loss to explain this composure. She smiled at his look. He knew that way she had of withdrawing into herself, and knew that it only happened when she had determined upon something without letting him know her plans. He was afraid of this, but he was so anxious to avoid a scene that he kept up appearances, and half sincerely believed in what he longed to believe in, for reasonableness. "I hope you won't be dull." "I hope not," said Anna. "I got a box of books yesterday from Gautier's. No, I shan't be dull." She's trying to take that tone, and so much the better, he thought, or else it would be the same thing over and over again. And he set off for the elections without appealing to her for a candid explanation. It was the first time since the beginning of their intimacy that he had parted from her without a full explanation. From one point of view, this troubled him, but on the other side, he felt that it was better so. At first there will be, as this time, something undefined, kept back, and then she will get used to it. In any case, I can give up anything for her, but not my masculine independence, he thought. Chapter 26. In September, Levin moved to Moscow for Kitty's confinement. He had spent a whole month in Moscow with nothing to do when Sergei Ivanovich, who had property in the Kuzhinsky province, and took great interest in the question of the approaching elections, made ready to set off to the elections. He invited his brother, who had a vote in the Selenovsky district, to come with him. Levin had, moreover, to transact in Kashin some extremely important business relating to the wardship and to the receiving of certain redemption money for his sister, who was abroad. Levin still hesitated, but Kitty, who saw that he was bored in Moscow and urged him to go, on her own authority, ordered him the proper nobleman's uniform, costing 80 rubles. And this 80 rubles paid for the uniform was the chief reason that finally decided Levin to go. He went to Kashin. Levin had been 5 days in Kashin, visiting the assembly each day, and busily engaged about his sister's business, which still dragged on. The district marshals of nobility were all occupied with the elections, and it was impossible to get the simplest thing done that depended upon the court of wardship. The other matter, the receipt of the sums due, was also met by difficulties. After long negotiations over the lifting of the prohibition, the money was at last ready to be paid, but the notary, a most obliging person, could not hand over the order, because it must have the signature of the president. And the president, though he had not given over his duties to a deputy, was at the elections. All these worrying negotiations, this endless going from place to place and talking with pleasant and excellent people, who quite saw the unpleasantness of the petitioner's position, but were powerless to assist him, all these efforts that yielded no result led to a feeling of misery in Levin akin to the mortifying helplessness one experiences in dreams when one tries to use physical force. He felt this frequently as he talked to his exceedingly good-natured solicitor. This solicitor did, it seemed, everything possible, and strained every nerve to get him out of his difficulties. "I tell you what you might try," he said more than once. "Go to so-and-so and so-and-so," and the solicitor drew up a regular plan for getting round the fatal point that hindered everything. But he would add immediately, "It'll mean some delay anyway, but you might try it." And Levin did try, and did go. Everyone was kind and civil, but the point evaded seemed to crop up again in the end, and again to bar the way. What was particularly trying was that Levin could not make out with whom he was struggling, to whose interest it was that his business should not be done. That no one seemed to know. The solicitor certainly did not know. If Levin could have understood why, just as he saw why one can only approach the booking office of a railway station in single file, it would not have been so vexatious and tiresome to him. But in the case of the hindrances that confronted him in his business, no one could explain why they existed. But Levin had changed a good deal since his marriage. He was patient, and if he could not see why it was all arranged like this, he told himself that he could not judge without knowing all about it, and that most likely it must be so, and he tried not to resent it. In attending the elections, too, and taking part in them, he tried now not to judge, not to fall foul of them, but to comprehend as fully as he could the question which was so earnestly and ardently absorbing honest and excellent men whom he respected. Since his marriage, there had been revealed to Levin so many new and serious aspects of life which had previously, through his frivolous attitudes to them, seemed of no importance, that in the question of the elections, too, he assumed and tried to find some serious significance. Sergei Ivanovich explained to him the meaning and object of the proposed radical change at the elections. The marshal of the province in whose hands the law had placed the control of so many important public functions, the guardianship of wards, the very department which was giving Levin so much trouble just now, the disposal of large sums subscribed by the nobility of the province, the high schools for girls, for boys, and military and primary instruction on the new statute, and finally, the Zemstvo, the marshal of the province, Snetkov, was a nobleman of the old school, dissipating an immense fortune, a good-hearted man, honest after his own fashion, but utterly without any comprehension of the needs of modern days. He always took, in every question, the side of the nobility. He was positively antagonistic to the spread of primary education, and he succeeded in giving a purely party character to the Zemstvo, which ought by rights to be of such an immense importance. What was needed was to put in his place a fresh, capable, perfectly modern man of contemporary ideas, and to frame their policy so as to derive from the rights conferred upon the nobles, not as the nobility, but as an element of the Zemstvo, all the benefits of self-government that could possibly be derived from them. In the wealthy Kuzhinsky province, which always took the lead of other provinces in everything, there was now such a preponderance of forces that this policy, once carried through properly there, might serve as a model for other provinces, for all Russia. And hence the whole question was of the greatest importance. It was proposed to elect as marshal in place of Snetkov, either Shevyatsky, or better still, Nevyedovsky, a former university professor, a man of remarkable intelligence, and a great friend of Sergei Ivanovich. The meeting was opened by the governor, who made a speech to the nobles, urging them to elect the public functionaries, not from regard for persons, but for the service and welfare of the native country, and hoping that the honorable nobility of the Kuzhinsky province would, as at all former elections, hold their duty as sacred, and vindicate the exalted confidence of the monarch. When he had finished his speech, the governor walked out of the hall, and the noblemen noisily and eagerly, some even enthusiastically, followed him and thronged round him while he put on his fur coat and conversed amicably with the marshal of the province. Levin, anxious to see into everything and not miss anything, also stood there in the crowd and heard the governor say, "Please tell Maria Ivanovna, my wife is very sorry, she could not visit the charity school." And thereupon the nobles in high good humor sorted out their fur coats and all drove off to the cathedral. In the cathedral, Levin, lifting his hand like the rest, and repeating the words of the dean, vowed with the most awesome oaths to do all the governor had hoped they would do. Church services always affected Levin, and as he uttered the words, "I kiss the cross," and glanced round at the crowd of young and old men repeating the same, he felt touched. On the second and third days, there was business relating to the finances of the nobility and the high school for girls, of no importance whatever, as Sergei Ivanovich explained, and Levin, busy seeing after his own affairs, did not attend the meetings. On the fourth day, the auditing of the marshal's accounts took place at the high table of the marshal of the province, and then there occurred the first skirmish between the new party and the old. The committee, which had been deputed to verify the accounts, reported to the meeting that all was in order. The marshal of the province got up, thanked the nobility for their confidence, and shed tears. The nobles gave him a loud welcome and shook hands with him. But at that instant, a nobleman of Sergei Ivanovich's party said that he had heard that the committee had not verified the accounts, considering such a verification an insult to the marshal of the province. One of the members of the committee incautiously admitted it. Then a small gentleman, very young-looking but very venomous, began to say that it would probably be agreeable to the marshal of the province to give an account of his expenditures of the public monies, and that the misplaced delicacy of the members of the committee was depriving him of his moral satisfaction. Then the members of the committee tried to withdraw their admission, and Sergei Ivanovich began to prove that they must logically admit either that they had verified the accounts or that they had not, and he developed this dilemma in detail. Sergei Ivanovich was answered by the talker of the opposite party. Then Sivyatsky spoke, and when the venomous gentleman again. The discussion lasted a long time and ended in nothing. Levin was surprised that they should dispute upon this subject so long, especially as, when he asked Sergei Ivanovich whether he supposed that money had been misappropriated, Sergei Ivanovich answered, "Oh, no, he's an honest man. But those old-fashioned methods of paternal family arrangements in the management of nobility affairs must be broken down." On the fifth day came the elections of the district marshals. It was rather a stormy day in several districts. In the Selenovsky district, Sivyatsky was elected unanimously without a ballot, and he gave a dinner that evening. Chapter 27. The sixth day was fixed for the election of the marshal of the province. The rooms, large and small, were full of noblemen in all sorts of uniforms. Many had come only for that day. Men who had not seen each other for years, some from the Crimea, some from Petersburg, some from abroad, met in the rooms of the Hall of Nobility. There was much discussion around the province table under the portrait of the Tsar. The nobles, both in the larger and in the smaller rooms, grouped themselves in camps, and from their hostile and suspicious glances, from the silence that fell upon them when outsiders approached a group, and from the way that some, whispering together, retreated to the farther corridor, it was evident that each side had secrets from the other. In appearance, the noblemen were sharply divided into two classes, the old and new. The old were for the most part either in the old uniform of the nobility, buttoned up closely with spurs and hats, or in their own special naval, cavalry, infantry uniforms earned by their former service. The uniforms of the older men were embroidered in the old-fashioned way with small puffs on their shoulders. They were unmistakably tight and short in the waist, as though their wearers had grown out of them. The younger men wore the uniform of the nobility, with long waist and broad shoulders, unbuttoned over white waistcoats, or uniforms with black collars and with the embroidered laurel leaves of justices of the peace. To the younger men belonged the court uniforms that here and there brightened up the crowd. But the division into young and old did not correspond with the division of parties. Some of the young men, as Levin observed, belonged to the old party, and some of the very oldest noblemen, on the contrary, were whispering with Sivyatsky and were evidently ardent partisans of the new party. Levin stood in the smaller room where they were smoking and taking light refreshments, close to his own friends and listening to what they were saying. He vainly exerted all his intelligence trying to understand what was said. Sergei Ivanovich was the center round which the others grouped themselves. He was listening at that moment to Sivyatsky and Khilostov, the marshal of another district who belonged to their party. Khilostov would not agree to go with his district to ask Snetkov to be a candidate, while Sivyatsky was persuading him to do so, and Sergei Ivanovich was approving of the plan. Levin could not make out why the opposition had to ask the marshal to be a candidate when they wanted to supersede him. Stepan Arkadyevich, who had just been drinking and taking some snack lunch, came up to them in his uniform of a gentleman of the bedchamber, wiping his lips with a perfumed handkerchief of bordered batiste. "We are placing our forces," he said, pulling out his side whiskers. "Sergei Ivanovich." In listening to the conversation, he supported Sviazhsky's contention. "One district's enough, and Sviazhsky, obviously of the opposition," he said, words evidently intelligible to all except Levin. "Why, Kostya, you, it seems, get the taste for these affairs, too," he added, turning to Levin and drawing his arm through his. Levin would have been glad indeed to get the taste for these affairs, but could not make out what the point was, and retreating a few steps from the speakers, he explained to Stepan Arkadyevich his inability to understand why the marshal of the province should be asked to be a candidate. "O sancta simplicitas," said Stepan Arkadyevich, and briefly and clearly he explained it to Levin. "If, as at previous elections, all the districts asked the marshal of the province to be a candidate, then he would be elected without a ballot. That must not be. Now 8 districts had agreed to call upon him. If 2 refused to do so, Snetkov might decline the candidacy entirely, and then the old party might choose another of their party, which would throw them completely out of their reckoning. But if only 1 district, Sviazhsky's, did not call upon him to be a candidate, Snetkov would let himself be balloted for. They were even, some of them, going to vote for him, and purposely to let him get a good many votes, so that the enemy might be thrown off the scent. And when a candidate of the other side was put up, they too might give him some votes.